Well, hello there, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. Sorry, it's a couple of days late. I've been off away on a holiday. I've been in Yosemite National Park here in California. One last Californian hurrah before I leave the country and move home to the United Kingdom. Had an amazing trip. I went there for an early birthday. My birthday is July 17th, but I'm going to be teaching the Clarion Science Fiction Writing Workshop while I'm on my birthday. So I'm going to be out there instead of at home. It'll be the first birthday in several years that I've worked. I try to make that sacrosanct, but somehow this year it just turns out that I'm working on my birthday, which kind of sucks, but it would suck a lot harder if it wasn't for the quality of the Clarion students that I'm going to be teaching. Clarion is the, for those of you who don't know, it's the kind of boot camp for science fiction writers, and among the graduates are me and Bruce Sterling, the guy who wrote the book that I'm reading today, along with many other luminaries, James Patrick Kelly and Nalo Hopkinson, and any number of others. Jeff Vandermeer, who's one of the instructors this year, was my classmate in 1992. So I've been reading through my Clarion students' manuscripts. There are 19 of these students, and boy, they've written some really top-notch stuff this year. There's really an awesome pile of writers there. While I'm at Clarion, this is the week after next, the week of July 17th, whatever day that starts on, I'm going to be doing some kind of signing and reading, I guess, at the Mysterious Galaxy bookstore in San Diego. I don't really know any details about it yet, but I'll have some in my podcast this weekend. The week after that, I'm back for a couple of days, and then I head right back down to San Diego for the Comic-Con, and I hope to see some of you there. I guess it's a big deal. 100,000-plus people turn up for it, so I'd be surprised if I didn't. I'm doing a couple of autographings and a couple of panels and trying to take in as much of it as I can while I'm down there. The other big news this week is I've got some new hardware. I bought a new X60 Lenovo ThinkPad from the good people at Emperor Linux, who sell laptops with Linux pre-installed on them, and they do an amazing job of supporting it. This is a totally unpaid, spontaneous endorsement. I've really enjoyed this machine. It's very nice to have a machine that's smaller and lighter weight than my old ThinkPad T60P, which was a big boat anchor of a machine, although very fast. This new thing is equally fast, but it's tiny, and I even put 4 gigs of RAM in it, which is making me a very happy man. So if any of you are thinking about buying a laptop with Linux on it, you could do a lot worse than to buy one of these machines from Emperor Linux at emperorlinux.com. They're good folks, and they do ship a fine laptop. So without any further hesitation or chatter, I'll go into the reading. This wild kid on the wires phenomenon was not confined to the USA. From the beginning, the same was true of the British phone system. An early British commentator kindly remarked, "No doubt boys in their teens found the work a little irksome, and it is also highly probable that under the early conditions of employment, the adventurous and inquisitive spirits of which the average healthy boy of that age is possessed were not always conducive to the best attention being given to the wants of the telephone subscribers." So the boys were flung off the system, or at least deprived of control of the switchboard. But the adventurous and inquisitive spirits of the teenage boys would be heard from in the world of telephony again and again. The fourth stage in the technological life cycle is death, the dog, dead tech. The telephone has so far avoided this fate. On the contrary, it is thriving, still spreading, still evolving, and at an increasing speed. The telephone has achieved a rare and exalted state for a technological artifact. It has become a household object. The telephone, like the clock, like pen and paper, like kitchen utensils and running water, has become a technology that is visible only by its absence. The telephone is technologically transparent. The global telephone system is the largest and most complex machine in the world, yet it is easy to use. More remarkable yet, the telephone is almost entirely physically safe for the user. For the average citizen in the 1870s, the telephone was weirder, more shocking, more high-tech, and harder to comprehend than the most outrageous stunts of advanced computing systems for us Americans in the 1990s. In trying to understand what is happening to us today with our bulletin board systems, direct overseas dialing, fiber optic transmissions, computer viruses, hacking stunts, and a vivid tangle of new laws and new crimes, it is important to realize that our society has been through a similar challenge before, and that, all in all, we did rather well by it. Bell stage telephones seemed bizarre at first, but the sensations of weirdness vanished quickly once people began to hear the familiar voices of relatives and friends in their own homes on their own telephones. The telephone changed from a fearsome high-tech totem to an everyday pillar of human community. This has also happened, and is still happening, to computer networks. Computer networks such as NSFNet, BitNet, Usenet, Janet are technologically advanced, intimidating, and much harder to use than telephones. Even the popular commercial computer networks such as Genie, Prodigy, and CompuServe cause much head-scratching and have been described as user-hateful. Nevertheless, they too are changing from fancy high-tech items into everyday sources of human community. The word community and communication have the same root. Wherever you put a communications network, you put a community as well. And whenever you take away that network, confiscate it, outlaw it, crash it, raise its price beyond affordability, then you hurt that community. Communities will fight to defend themselves. People will fight harder and more bitterly to defend their communities than they will fight to defend their own individual selves. And this is very true of the electronic community that arose around computer networks in the 1980s, or rather, the various electronic communities in telephony, law enforcement, computing, and the digital underground that, by the year 1990, were raiding, rallying, arresting, suing, jailing, fining, and issuing angry manifestos. None of the events of 1990 were entirely new. Nothing that happened in 1990 did not have some kind of earlier and more understandable precedent. What gave the hacker crackdown its new sense of gravity and importance was the feeling, the community feeling, that the political stakes had been raised, that trouble in cyberspace was no longer mere mischief or inconclusive skirmishing, but a genuine fight over genuine issues, a fight for community survival and the shape of the future. These electronic communities, having flourished throughout the 1980s, were becoming aware of themselves, and increasingly becoming aware of other, rival communities. Worries were sprouting up left and right, with complaints, rumors, uneasy speculations. But it would take a catalyst, a shock, to make the new world evident. Like Bell's great publicity break, the Terrafville rail disaster of January 1878, it would take a cause célèbre. That cause was the AT&T crash of January 15, 1990. After the crash, the wounded and anxious telephone community would come out fighting hard. The community of telephone technicians, engineers, operators, and researchers is the oldest community in cyberspace. These are the veterans, the most developed group, the richest, the most respectable, in most ways the most powerful. Whole generations have come and gone since Alexander Graham Bell's day, but the community he founded survives. People work for the phone system today whose great-grandparents worked for the phone system. Its specialty magazines, such as Telephony, AT&T Technical Journal, Telephone Engineer and Management, are decades old. They make computer publications like Macworld and PC Week look like amateur Johnny-come-latelys. And the phone companies take no back seats in high technology, either. The other companies' industrial researchers may have won new markets, but the researchers of Bell Labs have won 7 Nobel Prizes. One potent device that Bell Labs originated, the transistor, has created entire groups of industries. Bell Labs are world famous for generating a patent a day and have made even vital discoveries in astronomy, physics, and cosmology. Throughout its 70-year history, Ma Bell was not so much a company as a way of life. Until the cataclysmic divestiture of the 1980s, Ma Bell was perhaps the ultimate maternalist mega-employer. The AT&T corporate image was the gentle giant, the voice with a smile, a vaguely socialist realist world of clean-shaven linemen and shiny helmets and blandly pretty phone girls and headsets and nylons. Bell Systems employees were famous as rock-ribbed Kiwanis and Rotary members, Little League enthusiasts, school board people. During the long heyday of Ma Bell, the Bell employee corps were nurtured top to bottom on a corporate ethos of public service. There was good money in Bell, but Bell was not about money. Bell used public relations, but never mere marketeering. People went into the Bell system for a good life, and they had a good life. But it was not mere money that led Bell people out in the midst of storms and earthquakes to fight with toppled phone poles, to wait in flooded manholes, to pull the red-eyed graveyard shift over collapsing switching systems. The Bell ethic was the electrical equivalent of the postman's. Neither rain nor snow nor gloom of night would stop these couriers. It is easy to be cynical about this, as it is easy to be cynical about any political or social system. But cynicism does not change the fact that thousands of people took these ideals very seriously, and some still do. The Bell ethos was about public service, and that was gratifying, but it was also about private power, and that was gratifying too. As a corporation, Bell was very special. Bell was privileged. Bell had snuggled up close to the state. In fact, Bell was as close to government as you could get in America and still make a whole lot of legitimate money. But unlike other companies, Bell was above and beyond the vulgar commercial fray. Through its regional operating companies, Bell was omnipresent, local, and intimate all over America, but the central ivory towers at its corporate heart were the tallest and ivoriest around. There were other phone companies in America, to be sure, the so-called independents, rural cooperatives mostly, small fry, mostly tolerated, sometimes warred upon. For many decades, independent American phone companies lived in fear and loathing of the official Bell monopoly, or the Bell octopus, as Ma Bell's 19th century enemies described her in many angry newspaper manifestos. Some few of these independent entrepreneurs, while legally in the wrong, fought so bitterly against the octopus that their illegal phone networks were cast into the street by Bell agents and publicly burned. The pure technical sweetness of the Bell system gave its operators, inventors, and engineers a deeply satisfying sense of power and mastery. They had devoted their lives to improving this vast nation-spanning machine. Over years, whole human lives, they had watched it improve and grow. It was like a great technological temple. They were an elite, and they knew it, even if others did not. Power should never be underestimated. Technical power is not for everybody. For many people, it simply has no charm at all. But for some people, it becomes the core of their lives. For a few, it is overwhelming, obsessive. It becomes something close to an addiction. People, especially clever teenage boys whose lives are otherwise mostly powerless and put upon, love the sensation of secret power and are willing to do all sorts of amazing things to achieve it. The technical power of electronics has motivated many strange acts detailed in this book, which would otherwise be inexplicable. So Bell had power beyond mere capitalism. The Bell service ethos worked and was often propagandized in a rather saccharine fashion. Over the decades, people slowly grew tired of all this, and then openly impatient with it. By the early 1980s, Ma Bell was to find herself with scarcely a real friend in the world. Vail's industrial socialism had become hopelessly out of fashion politically. Bell would be punished for that, and that punishment would fall harshly upon the people of the telephone community. In 1983, Ma Bell was dismantled by federal court action. The pieces of Bell are now separate corporate entities. The core of the company became AT&T Communications, and also AT&T Industries, formerly Western Electric, Bell's manufacturing arm. AT&T Bell Labs became Bell Communications Research, Bellcor. Then there are the regional Bell operating companies, or RBOCs, pronounced Arbox. Bell was a titan, and even these regional chunks are gigantic enterprises, Fortune 50 companies with plenty of wealth and power behind them. But the clean lines of one policy, one system, universal service have been shattered, apparently forever. The one policy of the early Reagan administration was to shatter a system that smacked of non-competitive socialism. Since that time, there has been no real telephone policy on the federal level. Despite the breakup, the remnants of Bell have never been set free to compete in the open marketplace. The RBOCs are still very heavily regulated, but not from the top. Instead, they struggle politically, economically, and legally in what seems like an endless turmoil, in a patchwork of overlapping federal and state jurisdictions. Increasingly, like other major American corporations, the RBOCs are becoming multinational, acquiring important commercial interests in Europe, Latin America, and the Pacific Rim. But this, too, adds to their legal and political predicament. The people of what used to be Ma Bell are not happy about their fate. They feel ill-used. they might have been grudgingly willing to make a full transition to the free market, to become just companies amid other companies. But this never happened. Instead, AT&T and the RBOX, or the Baby Bells, feel themselves wrenched from side to side by state regulators, by Congress, by the FCC, and especially by the federal court judge of Judge Harold Green, the magistrate who ordered the Bell breakup and who has been the de facto czar of American telecommunications ever since 1983. Bell people feel that they exist in a kind of paralegal limbo today. They don't understand what's demanded of them. If it's service, why aren't they treated like a public service? And if it's money, then why aren't they free to compete for it? No one seems to know, really. Those who claim to know keep changing their minds. Nobody in authority seems willing to grasp the nettle once and for all. Telephone people from other countries are amazed by the American telephone system today. Not that it works so well, for nowadays even the French telephone system works more or less. They're amazed that the Americans' telephone system still works at all under these strange conditions. Bell's one system of long-distance service is now only about 80% of a system, with the remainder held by Sprint, MCI, and the midget long-distance companies. Ugly wars over dubious corporate practices such as slamming, an underhanded method of snitching clients from rivals, break out with some regularity in the realm of long-distance service. The battle to break Bell's long-distance monopoly was long and ugly, and since the breakup, the battlefield has not become much prettier. AT&T's famous shame-and-blame advertisements, which emphasized the shoddy work and purported ethical shadiness of their competitors, were much remarked upon for their studied psychological cruelty. There is much bad blood in this industry, and much long-treasured resentment. AT&T's post-breakup corporate logo, a striped sphere, is known in the industry as the Death Star, a reference from the movie Star Wars, in which the Death Star was the spherical high-tech fortress of the harsh-breathing Imperial ultra-baddie, Darth Vader. Even AT&T employees are less than thrilled by the Death Star. A popular, though banned, t-shirt among AT&T employees bears the old-fashioned Bell logo of the Bell system, plus the newfangled striped sphere with the before-and-after comments, "This is your brain. This is your brain on drugs." AT&T made a very well-financed and determined effort to break into the personal computer network. It was disastrous, and telco computer experts are derisively known by their competitors as the pole climbers. AT&T and the Baby Bell RBOX seem still to have few friends. Under conditions of sharp commercial competition, a crash like that of January 5, 1990 was a major embarrassment to AT&T. It was a direct blow against their much-treasured reputation for reliability. Within days of the crash, AT&T's chief executive officer, Bob Allen, officially apologized in terms of deeply pained humility. Quote, "AT&T has had a major service disruption last Monday. We didn't live up to our own standards of quality, and we didn't live up to yours. It's as simple as that, and that's not acceptable to us, or to you. We understand how much people have come to depend on AT&T service, so our AT&T Bell Laboratory scientists and our network engineers are doing everything possible to guard against a reoccurrence. We know there's no way to make up for the inconvenience this problem may have caused you." End quote. Mr. Allen's open letter to customers was printed in lavish ads all over the country in the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, Philadelphia Inquirer, San Francisco Chronicle Examiner, Boston Globe, Dallas Morning News, Detroit Free Press, Washington Post, Houston Chronicle, Cleveland Plain Dealer, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Minneapolis Star Tribune, St. Paul Pioneer Press Dispatch, Seattle Times Post Intelligencer, Tacoma News Tribune, Miami Herald, Pittsburgh Press, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Denver Post, Phoenix Republic Gazette, and Tampa Tribune. In another press release, AT&T went to some pains to suggest that this software glitch might have happened just as easily to MCI, although, in fact, it hadn't. MCI switching software was quite different from AT&T's, though not necessarily any safer. AT&T also announced their plans to offer a rebate of service on Valentine's Day to make up for the loss during the crash. "Every technical resource available, including Bell Lab scientists and engineers, have been devoted to assuring that it will not occur again," the public was told. They were further assured that the chances of a recurrence are small. A problem of this magnitude never occurred before. In the meantime, however, police and corporate security maintain their own suspicions about the chances of recurrence, and the real reason why a problem of this magnitude had appeared, seemingly out of nowhere. Police and security knew for a fact that hackers of unprecedented sophistication were illegally entering and reprogramming certain digital switching stations. Rumors of hidden viruses and secret logic bombs in the switches ran rampant in the underground, with much chortling over AT&T's predicament and idle speculation over what unsung hacker genius was responsible for it. Some hackers, including police informants, were trying hard to finger one another as true culprits of the crash. Telco people found little comfort in objectivity when they contemplated these possibilities. It was just too close to the bone for them. It was embarrassing. It hurt so much, it was hard even to talk about. There has always been thieving and misbehavior in the phone system. There had always been trouble with rival independents and in the local loops. But to have such trouble in the core of the system, the long-distance switching stations, is a horrifying affair. To telco people, this is all the difference between finding roaches in your kitchen and big horrid sewer rats in your bedroom. From the outside, to the average citizen, the telcos still seem giant and impersonal. The American public seems to regard them as something akin to Soviet apparats. Even when the telcos do their best corporate citizen routines, subsidizing magnet high schools and sponsoring news shows on public television, they seem to win little except public suspicion. But from the inside, all this looks very different. There's harsh competition, a legal and political system that seems baffled and bored when not actively hostile to telco interests. There's a loss of morale, a deep sensation of having somehow lost the upper hand. Technological change has caused a loss of data and revenue to other, newer forms of transmission. There's theft, and new forms of theft, of growing scale and boldness and sophistication. With all these factors, it was no surprise to see the telcos, large and small, break out in a litany of bitter complaint. In late 88 through 1989, telco representatives grew shrill in their complaints to those few American law enforcement officials who make it their business to try to understand what telephone people are talking about. Telco security officials had discovered that the computer hacker underground, infiltrated it thoroughly, and become deeply alarmed at its growing expertise. Here they had found a target that was not only loathsome on its face, but clearly ripe for counterattack. Those bitter rivals, AT&T, MCI, and Sprint, and a crowd of baby Bells, Pac Bell, Bell South, Southwestern Bell, 9X, U.S. West, as well as the Bell Research Consortium and Bellcore, and the independent long-distance carrier MidAmerican, were all to have their role in the great hacker dragnet of 1990. After years of being battered and pushed around, the telcos had, at least in a small way, seized the initiative again. After years of turmoil, telcos and government officials were once again to work smoothly in concert in defense of the system. Optimism blossomed, enthusiasm grew on all sides, the prospective taste of vengeance was sweet. From the beginning, even before the crackdown had a name, secrecy was a big problem. There were many good reasons for secrecy in the hacker crackdown. Hackers and code thieves were wily prey, slinking back to their bedrooms and basements and destroying vital incriminating evidence at the first hint of trouble. Furthermore, the crimes themselves were heavily technical and difficult to describe, even to police, much less to the general public. When such crimes had been described intelligibly to the public in the past, that very publicity had tended to increase the crimes enormously. Telco officials, while painfully aware of the vulnerabilities of their systems, were anxious not to publicize these weaknesses. Experience showed them that these weaknesses, once discovered, would be pitilessly exploited by tens of thousands of people, not only by professional grifters and by underground hackers and phone freaks, but by many otherwise more or less honest everyday folks who regarded stealing service from the faceless, soulless phone company as a kind of harmless indoor sport. When it came to protecting their interests, telcos had long since given up on general public sympathy for the voice with a smile. Nowadays, the telco's voice was very likely to be a computer's, and the American public showed much less of the proper respect and gratitude due to the fine public service bequeathed them by Dr. Bell and Mr. Vail. The more efficient, high-tech, computerized, and impersonal telcos became, it seemed, the more they were met by sullen public resentment and amoral greed. telco officials wanted to publish the Phone Freak Underground as in public and in as public and exemplary a manner as possible. They wanted to make dire examples of the worst offenders, to seize the ringleaders, and intimidate the small fry, to discourage and frighten the wacky hobbyists, and send the professional grifters to jail. To do all this, publicity was vital. Yet operational secrecy was even more so. If word got out that a nationwide crackdown was coming, the hackers might simply vanish, destroy the evidence, hide their computers, go to Earth, and wait for the campaign to blow over. Even the young hackers were crafty and suspicious, and as for the professional grifters, they tended to split for the nearest state line at the first sign of trouble. For the crackdown to work well, they would all have to be caught red-handed, swept upon suddenly, out of the blue, from every corner of the compass. And there was another strong motive for secrecy. In the worst-case scenario, a blown campaign might leave the telcos open to a devastating hacker counterattack. If there were indeed hackers loose in America who had caused the January 15th crash, and if they were truly gifted hackers loose in the nation's long-distance switching systems and enraged or frightened by the crackdown, they might react unpredictably to an attempt to collar them. Even if caught, they might have talented and vengeful friends still running around loose. Conceivably, it could turn ugly. Very ugly. In fact, it was hard to imagine just how ugly things might turn given that possibility. Counterattack from hackers was a genuine concern for the telcos. In point of fact, they never would suffer any such counterattack, but in months to come, they would be at some pains to publicize this notion and to utter grim warnings about it. Still, that risk seemed well worth running. Better to risk run the risk of vengeful attacks than to live at the mercy of potential crashers. Any cop will tell you that a protection racket has no real future. And publicity was such a useful thing. Corporate security officers, including telco security, generally work under conditions of great discretion. And corporate security officials do not make money for their companies. Their job is to prevent the loss of money, which is much less glamorous than actually winning profits. If you are a corporate security official and you do your job brilliantly, then nothing bad happens to the company at all. Because of this, you appear completely superfluous. This is one of the many unattractive aspects of security work. It's rare that these folks have the chance to draw some healthy attention to their own efforts.